Hey, Prime members, you can listen to The Vanished ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the app today.
The parents of the missing child, Deborah Bradley and Jeremy Irwin, would like to make a statement, and they will not be answering questions afterward.
On Monday night or Tuesday morning, our daughter Lisa was taken from our home. We just urge anyone that has any kind of information as to where she is or who she's with or anything to please call the tipped hotline or the police. Anything, even the smallest bit of information, could help lead to her return. Anybody that might have her, they can drop her off at any place safe, fire station or hospital or a church. No questions asked. We just want to have her back home.
We just want our baby back. Please, bring her home. Our two other boys are waiting for her, please. Just drop her off anywhere. We don't care. Just somewhere safe where she can come home, please.
We wanted to thank everyone who's out here, the kids, city police, FBI, search and rescue, all the volunteers that are helping with the investigation, and Center of Missing Children. And just ask you to keep her in her thoughts and prayers and help her bring her home. Thank you.
Thank you, everyone.
Hello, and welcome to episode 32 of The Vanished. Tonight, I will be discussing the disappearance of 10-month-old Lisa Irwin. Lisa's disappearance was suggested by many, many listeners. I usually shy away from cases that have received a lot of media attention, but this case intrigued me because the police investigation has focused so much of its energy on the parents, but there is a lot of evidence to suggest that this was a true abduction. There will be a guest at the end of the show that most of you know and love. I will keep you in suspense for now, but it is also in the show notes if you can't wait. Lisa was last seen by her mother, Deborah Bradley, around 6:40 p.m. on October 3rd, 2011. Deborah had put Lisa down in her crib for the night in their home in Kansas City, Missouri. Imagine waking up one morning to find that your child is missing from your home. All you have left are the memories, pictures, and home videos.
Who are you talking to? Drink your baba. Look at the messy baby. Say hi, my mom. Hi, my mom. What are you doing? What was that?
This story has a lot of documented facts, although many have slight discrepancies on certain times. I would like to start the timeline earlier in the day so you can get a better understanding of the events. There are a lot of people associated with this story, so I'll try to keep it all sorted out for you. At the time of Lisa's disappearance, she was living with her parents, Jeremy and Deborah, and her two older half-brothers. Both Deborah and Jeremy each had a son from a previous relationship. Around 2:30 on the 3rd, Lisa's father came home from work. He ate and then played with Lisa and her two older brothers. At 4:30, Deborah left with her brother, Philip, to go to the store while Jeremy stayed home with the kids. Deborah and Philip were captured on surveillance cameras at 4:45 purchasing baby food and a box of wine. Also around this time, a neighbor, Samantha, stopped over and checked on Lisa in her crib. Deborah and her brother got back to the house at approximately 5 p.m. At 5:15, Jeremy's boss called with a work-related question and heard Lisa in the background. These may seem like mundane facts, but they helped establish a time frame that we know Lisa was in the home and alive. Jeremy left at 5:30 to go work an evening shift doing electrical work at a Starbucks. This is not something that Jeremy usually did, but money was tight and they needed the extra income. He told Deborah that he will be home around 10 p.m. Deborah's brother also left around this time. Deborah then made dinner for her family and also the neighbor Samantha and her daughter. There are several conflicting reports on the exact time, but neighbor Samantha left sometime around 6 p.m. to go purchase alcohol. She returned between 6:30 and 7, depending on what report you go with, and Samantha's daughter saw Deborah put Lisa in her crib. Lisa's older brothers and Samantha's daughter played in the house all evening while Deborah and Samantha sat on the porch smoking cigarettes and drinking. Deborah consumed between 5 and 10 glasses of wine between 6:30 and 10:30 p.m. Another neighbor, Shane, joined them on the porch that night. There are conflicting reports about exactly when Shane came over. Some say 7 and some say 8. He stayed for about an hour and a half and chatted with the two women. He did not see any children while he was over there. Around 10:30, Deborah went to bed. She is not completely sure if she checked on Lisa or if she locked the door due to being intoxicated. This has caused a lot of controversy because she initially told police that she checked on her at 10:30, but later admitted that she was unsure. Her neighbor Samantha stayed outside for a bit, smoking a cigarette and talking to a neighbor. She remembered seeing lights turning off inside the Irwin house before she retired for the night at 11:30. The boys had fallen asleep in Deborah's bed, so she went to bed next to them with a stray kitten that she had taken in earlier that day. The older boy eventually got up and went to sleep in his own bed. When Deborah went to bed, she left three cell phones on the counter. Their cell phones had been turned off earlier that day due to non-payment. At 11:57 p.m., a call was attempted from one of those phones. Someone had tried to call a phone owned by a woman named Megan Wright. Make a mental note here, this is an important detail. Deborah and Jeremy claim they do not know Megan, and Megan claims she does not know them. Investigators went back a full year in their phone records and could not find any communication between Megan and Deborah or Megan and Jeremy. Around 12:15 a.m., a neighbor left to go to work. He noticed a man carrying a baby down the street. He thought this was odd, so he paused for a few minutes to watch. The man's wife looked out the window and saw her husband standing there watching something, so she looked out and also observed the man with the baby.
It was about 12:15. My husband was leaving for work, and we were paying attention. He kind of stopped and was looking down the street, which was kind of odd, because normally he just gets straight into his car and then leaves. At that time, whenever I looked out and I kept watching him, he was kind of looking down in the bushes, and the next thing you know, we seen a gentleman walking up the street carrying a baby. My husband was standing right next to we had another vehicle out there, and he was standing at that vehicle, and he was looking down the street, and then all of a sudden, he turned and he was looking at the gentleman because he was walking up that way. Wearing like a dark colored pants and what we believe was a t-shirt. Like a white t-shirt, and then he had the baby in his arms, and he had the baby's head kind of like this, so we just kind of seen the baby's arm, and then the leg was down here, and he was kind of just like, I don't know if he was trying to protect it from the cold, or if he just, you know, he was just holding the baby. It was pretty odd, and that's why my husband kind of waited a few minutes before he actually left for work, so then when he drove, the gentleman was still kind of walking. The gentleman wasn't actually like acting like suspicious or anything. He was just kind of walking at a steady pace, not in a hurry. Then the gentleman actually turned like he was going to go in the grass to go into one of the houses up the street. Mm-hmm. So that's why at that time we did not think anything of it. And then at that time my husband did call me after he left to have me look outside to make sure that the gentleman was not outside any longer. And at that time when I looked up the street, I didn't see anything else.
At 2:15 a.m., a surveillance video at a BP gas station showed what appeared to be a man wearing a white t-shirt leaving a wooded area. At 2:30 a.m., a dumpster fire was reported near the Irwin home in the Brighton Townhomes complex.
Number 34, investigate a dumpster fire. 4897 Northeast 37th Street, South Brighton Townhouses. Number 34, investigate a dumpster fire. 489.
This is about a 3-minute walk from the Irwin house. It is believed that this fire was started around 2 a.m., so it is about a 15-minute walk from the dumpster to the gas station where the man was seen on a surveillance video. If the fire was in fact started at 2 a.m., the man being at the BP gas station at 2:15 matches up time-wise. At 3:17 a.m., someone attempted to check the voicemail and access the internet on one of the cell phones belonging to the Irwin family. At 3:22 a.m., someone tried to check the voicemail and internet again. There were 3 more attempts to get on the internet in those early morning hours. Remember I mentioned earlier that Jeremy Irwin thought that he would be home by 10 p.m. Well, that job that he went to took much longer than anticipated. He was captured on a surveillance video working at the Starbucks until 3:30 a.m. He arrived home around 3:45 a.m. and was irritated because the family was struggling financially and several of the lights were left on in the house. The front door was unlocked and the screen on the computer room window appeared to have been pushed in. He was also unhappy to see that Deborah had taken in a kitten. I would also like to remind you here that the neighbor had seen the lights go off in the Irwin home between 10:30 and 11:30. So when Jeremy returns home at 3:45, the lights are now on. Jeremy woke up Deborah and then checked on the older son, who was asleep in his room, and then went to check on Lisa, only to find her crib empty. He ran next door to Samantha's house to see if she had Lisa, but she did not. They went to call 911, but noticed that their 3 phones were missing. I would like to briefly explain why they had 3 phones. One was Jeremy's personal phone, one was Deborah's, but it was broken, and the 3rd was loaned to Deborah by her grandfather since hers was broken. The FBI has stated that those phones never got more than 1/3 of a mile away from the Irwin home the night that Lisa vanished. Luckily, Jeremy had a phone that was provided to him by his employer, and he was able to call 911 at 4 a.m.
Even though his brain is busted and his 10-month-old daughter is missing, he advised that he didn't witness anything and don't know how long she's been gone at 4:04.
Can you repeat the call details, please?
And the caller says that he noticed that his 10-month-old daughter was missing, and he's not sure how long she's been gone, and the screen is busted, and he didn't witness anything at 4:05. What do you need the number for?
Kidnapping.
Complaint number is 1107-1958
at 4:10 a.m., a man on a motorcycle spotted a man carrying a baby. He remembered it because he thought it was so odd. When he heard about Lisa's disappearance, he contacted the police because he was convinced that it was, in fact, Lisa in the man's arms. The area where he spotted this man was about an hour walk from the Irwin home. An Amber Alert was issued that morning.
We are continuing to follow that breaking news out of the Northland. An Amber Alert has been issued after an apparent abduction of a 10-month-old baby. Police were called to the house about 4 o'clock this morning. They say evidence at the scene indicates this was an abduction, and it appears the suspect entered and exited through a bedroom window. There is a picture of little Lisa Irwin here. She is 10 months old with blonde hair, blue eyes. We're told she's about 30 inches long, weighs about 30 pounds. Again, she was last seen in her crib about 10:30 last night. Police are asking anyone with information about this to please call police or call the TIPS hotline. Again, an Amber Alert issued for little 10-month-old Lisa Irwin, something that we'll continue to follow.
This case quickly turned into a media circus. This is a clip from the parents speaking to the media. I would like to play it for you so you can hear the story in their own words. You can judge for yourself if you think they are being truthful.
Just please bring her home.
Jeremy, as we understand, you came home in the overnight hours. What did you find at 4 a.m. when you walked in the door?
When I came home from work, the front door was unlocked. Most of the lights were on in the house, and the window was in the front was open. Obviously, all very unusual. Then I started checking on the kids, checked on the boys first, and then we checked on her. That's when we realized she was gone.
Can you imagine, Jeremy, where anyone who would want to take your daughter who wants to harm your family.
No. The only thing I can think of is, you know, maybe somebody wanted a baby and she... I hope that's what it is.
What do you want to tell that person other than dropping them off? I mean, what do you want to tell them about Lisa?
She's everything. She's our little girl. She's completed her family and she means everything to my boys and we need her home. I can't be without her.
Deborah, how are you explaining to the two boys what has happened? How are they taking all this in?
I just try to tell them, you know, we're going to stay strong. We're a family. We're going to pray. And she's going to come home. And that we have to be strong for her.
I understand that you are showing pictures to the boys and that you call her pumpkin pie. Can you talk to us about that and what the boys are saying, what they're wondering?
They just, every time we talk to somebody, the police or anything, we run up and they give us a hug and say, did they find her yet? We always tell them, not yet, not yet. It's the only thing we know to tell them.
Can you talk about raising your hand here?
This is her Barney that she sleeps with every night. Sometimes she won't go to sleep without it, so I'd like to have her back so she can have her Barney and her family, her brothers. We need her home.
Did it look like anything was disturbed in her room? I mean, did anything look out of place other than her not being there?
No. No. It's like they just walked in and just disappeared.
They took her and took all of our phones so we couldn't call anybody.
They took your cell phone?
Yeah. They took all the phones.
They were on the counter in the kitchen. And there was, I woke up and he came home and he said, she's not in a crib. And I said, what do you mean she's not in a crib? And I just knew, you know, something was really wrong. And we're going around the house and we're screaming for her and she was nowhere. And then I said, call 911. And he said, where are the phones? And they weren't on the counter where I left them. They were gone.
Did the boys hear anything at all? You said you had to wake the boys. Did they not hear anything coming in the window?
I don't think so. The window that was open is nowhere near their bedroom. So I don't think they heard anything. They're both pretty heavy sleepers.
What's on the other side of that window that was left open? Is that the living room window? Bedroom?
It's a computer room where it's an extra living room.
How do you move forward with police being here, with your lives being... Have you had any sleep? Tell us what you did today.
We've had a couple hours, but not much. I mean, I close my eyes, I see her. But I mean, we're just trying to hold it together for our boys and for her. And, you know, stay strong for her so that we can try to think of anything or anyone or any reason this might have happened. We still haven't, but...
Are you saying both your phones were taken as well?
Yeah. Three were taken. One wasn't even working, and it was sitting up there next to the other ones. I was reprogramming all the numbers, and all three of them were gone.
What else was missing from your home? Anything else?
We didn't look, but nothing. I don't think so. I don't think anything. I mean, we called the cops. We ran outside and waited for him, and, you know, he was looking around outside, and I was, you know, just holding my boys, and they were crying, asking what's going on, where is she at, why is she gone, and, I mean, you know, the police came, and I waved them down. I mean, I didn't even check around the house. I didn't think to care about any of that. I still don't.
Talk to us about your last moments with Lisa. I mean, what were you saying?
Change her, you know, put fresh clothes on her, and get her ready for bed, and give her a bottle, and I made sure her binky was in her crib in case she needed it, and she sleeps with her Barney, and she sleeps with her glowworm and her blanket, and that was it.
How hopeful are you that you are going to find her safe?
I'm terrified, but I'm trying to be hopeful.
You folks said that you didn't know anybody that might want to do this, but did you notice anyone that had maybe an unusual interest in your child?
I know everybody loves her. I mean, I go to the store and everybody says she's beautiful and she likes everybody. She's really playful and she's really sweet and she'll go to almost anyone. I mean, so I mean, anything beyond that, no.
So it wouldn't surprise you that she was picked up without crying.
Right.
Well, yes, she's sleeping. You can, I mean, sometimes she cries. It depends on how long of sleep she's had. But, I mean, if you pick her up and you cuddle with her, she probably won't cry.
Thank you so much. We appreciate it.
Thank you for coming out.
Police held a news conference on the afternoon of the 4th to give an update on the progress of the search.
At this point, we've exhausted everything that we can at that original scene. And since that time, we're still holding the house as a crime scene. But since that time, we've opened up the crime scene and just broadened it and started doing an area canvas and searching everything we can. Right now, we're getting help from the FBI, the ATF, the Marshal's Office, ICE, Clay County. We have all of our Narcotics and Vice Division out here. We have our TAC units out here. We have our Fugitive App unit out here. We have Mounted Patrol. So we are just expanding and doing everything we can.
You're not looking at anything in particular then at this moment?
You know, they're working some angles, but we do not have any hard leads that we can say we're looking for this type of person or anything yet. But
how often is it that you actually bring out the Mounted Patrol for a kidnapping?
I can't remember it happening, but the way this is developed, you know, usually we find the kid pretty quickly. If it's, you know, if the story's kind of hinky, we usually find holes in it pretty quickly. But so far, here we are in the afternoon, and we haven't broken anything on it yet. No.
When you say you haven't found any holes in this story, can you describe what the role of the parents is at this time? Are they being held just for answering questions, or is it more than that?
Well, you can say that we're holding, but I would also say that they're being cooperative. So they're obviously an essential part of the investigation, and we're continuing to talk to them, and they're continuing to be cooperative.
And why are two other children that were involved?
There were.
Have you been talking to them? What have they...
Well, there are two other children. I'm sure that we've spoken to them, but I don't know what we've gotten from them.
Was anything taken from the house besides the child?
Not that I'm aware of, no. And if there was, I probably wouldn't be able to address it.
Have you been able to identify yet exactly how this person did get in?
Well, originally, you know, there was a window on the front of the house that appeared to have been tampered with. That's something that they were looking at, but we're not really sure if that's the entry point or not. That's just a detail. The main point is that there's a 10-month-old that isn't where she belongs, and we're trying to find that child.
Why a grid search and why here?
Well, because we're just breaking out larger from the house. You know, you start with the house, you exhaust everything there, and then you just keep going bigger, and we'll keep going bigger as long as we need to.
Outside of location, is there any specific reason of why you chose this area to set up the command post?
Just convenience for the command post. That's right.
Have you gotten any indications that the story is hinky?
Not that I'm aware of, no. And they continue to be cooperative, and our detectives continue to work them.
Well, yes. Sarah told us last night that she saw a suspicious person with a baby around 1 a.m. Do you know if that's a credible lead or not?
Well, I do know that somebody did contact us and say that, you know, late last night, early this morning, I'm not sure of an exact time, that she did see somebody walking down the street with a baby. That is something that we've looked into. I don't know if it's necessarily led anywhere. And by all means, if anybody does have information that would parlay off of that, we would encourage them to call the TIPS hotline.
Were both parents home all night?
I'm not sure if they were all home all night. I don't know.
Is this Amber Alert concentrated just in Kansas City, or is it going by state, or is it?
Well, the Amber Alert is here, but we've also disseminated the information statewide, so we're broadening it as much as we can.
Can you describe a little bit about how unusual it is to have this type of alleged kidnapping? Because usually when you have an Amber Alert, we often hear that it's an ex-boyfriend or a relative of some sort of custody issue. How is this different?
Well, an Amber Alert isn't designed for a custody issue, but you're right. Sometimes it does lead to that quickly, and we find out that that was the answer after we initiated an Amber Alert. This time we have not had that road open up to us, and that's what makes this one different.
So it is thought to be simply a stranger came into the home and took the child.
That's the information we have right now.
Extensive searches were done of the area nearby, including waterways and a landfill, but nothing was ever found that could be connected to Lisa. A cadaver dog did alert to a spot on the floor near Deborah's bed. On the 7th, Deborah was given a polygraph and was told that she failed. A backpack and soiled diapers were found in a nearby abandoned house. They looked to be older, and it was eventually confirmed that they were not related to Lisa. About a month after Lisa disappeared, Jeremy's debit card was used to make a fraudulent purchase on a website that provided name-changing services. It has also been said that you could purchase fake birth certificates on this website. The website now redirects to a stationary website, so we can't see what it looked like at the time. The attorney for the family was able to take a screenshot of the website back then and handed that information over to the police, but they believe the authorities have not taken it seriously. There is a man that many suspect is connected to Lisa's disappearance, although the police say that he has cooperated and they have moved on from him. His name is John Tanko, but he goes by the nickname Jersey. He has a timeline of his own for that day. He was staying at a home around the corner from the Irwin home. The owners of this residence were away, and he was taking care of their yard. A woman who lived next door to the home that he was staying in went to run errands that day and observed Jersey working in the yard around 1 p.m. While she was gone, another neighbor saw Jersey walk off with her dog. This dog was eventually found several miles away a few days later. Around 9 p.m., the woman who had seen him at 1 p.m. noticed that the sprinklers were on in the yard of the home that Jersey was staying at. By 11 p.m., the sprinklers were off, and she assumed that he was the one that turned them off since he was in charge of taking care of the yard. The couple who witnessed a man walking with a baby that evening said that the man turned into the yard of the home that Jersey was taking care of. If you walk through the yard of that home, it comes out to an apartment complex. That complex happens to be where the dumpster fire took place that night. The road that runs through the complex leads to the BP gas station where the camera picked up someone coming out of the woods in the early morning hours. This is one of the neighbors describing Jersey.
Well, Jersey did handyman work for our next door neighbor that lived obviously next door to us, and he was around a lot, and we got to know him as an acquaintance, and he, you know, talked to us on many occasions, and our neighbor told us that the night that that baby went missing, the man who was seen coming up the street came and went on our property and through our next-door neighbor's gate and up, you know, we're going up towards, there's a hill that goes up towards some townhomes that are behind us. Well, he definitely was suspicious and kind of shady, I would say. He kind of just comes out of nowhere. He never is specific on where he's been or where he's going. You'd kind of see him around the neighborhood and just pop in and talk to you. He was always friendly, but he definitely let us know in the last probably week before all of this happened that he was wanted for an outstanding warrant that he had for his arrest, which was kind of a shock to us. So definitely.
Remember the phone call that I mentioned earlier from one of the missing phones? It was made to Megan Wright, and guess what? She is Jersey's ex-girlfriend. They had broken up just 10 days earlier. Megan has made numerous appearances on television and even set up a Facebook page to answer questions. She lived in the Brighton Townhomes complex and says that there were 7 people in her home the night that Lisa vanished. She had let those 7 people use her phone, so whoever was trying to call her phone may have been attempting to reach one of those people as well. Jersey has a history of robbing homes in the Kansas City area. There has been a lot of speculation about the parents not cooperating with the police. An attorney for the family explained this to the press.
The main thing I want to get across is that there was this bit about no cooperation. It's just fantasy. They've cooperated from day one. They have, and I'm talking about Debbie and Jeremy, they've been interviewed / interrogated in excess of 30 hours on 5 different occasions. It's been reported, and I saw it again last night, that the delay in interviewing the boys was due to Debbie and Jeremy. And that is just patently untrue. When I got involved in the case with Joe, it was November 1st. We immediately met, went over the case, met the clients, and then we went to the FBI, spent about 3 hours. They laid out the case, what they had, the evidence, what the investigation was going. We talked about what we would do and not do. And we agreed right then on November 1st that the boys would be, that Debbie and Jeremy would allow the boys to be re-interviewed We set some ground rules. The ground rules were that the entire thing should be videotaped. Typically, when you have a forensic person come in and do an interview of children, just like when you have an interrogation of a suspect, the pre-interview portion is not videoed. And with the child, and mainly, you know, you deal with children with child sex cases, the pre-interview part is just rapport building. And they get them in a room, and it's, you know, it's got little furniture in it and some toys and games, and they call and whatnot, and they build a rapport. We felt it was important to document that, and the FBI agreed with that. It was the FBI that asked us to wait for the interview. They have forensic examiners, just a small number, and they're all in D.C., so the reason it didn't take place until last night was due to the fact that that was when she was available. And she flew in yesterday morning. I met with her yesterday afternoon. I interviewed her very briefly about her experience level. She's been with the FBI for about 10 years, has done over 1,000 forensic interviews. Usually, my experience has been most of those people are very good at their jobs. You know, they're going to ask neutral questions or non-leading questions because that we get the video of, and it would be foolish of them to do otherwise. And then other than that, Joe and I were both very concerned about the boys. And the first thing they said to me when I sat down at the kitchen table and talked to them was, the older one said, are you going to help us find Lisa? So, you know, if you guys have kids, you know how older siblings like infants. And so it's a traumatic experience for them. And that was, you know, the main concern that Joe and I both had. I think it went well. They were in there for a couple of hours. They came out. They seemed to be in good spirits. The message I want to get out is that the level of cooperation from Debbie and from Jeremy has been there from day one before I was involved in the case. And that this business about the children not being allowed to be interviewed is untrue also. Joe wanted it to happen. We said that it would happen as early as November 1st. The reason it didn't happen until last night was due to the FBI and scheduling conflicts and nothing on our side.
How about interviews with parents?
You know, at this point, there's nothing more to be said. I mean, 30-plus hours of interviews, interrogations. I'm not going to get into the specifics of what went on and how it broke down. I will later. You know, if there's things that they still need to know or questions that they want to ask, they can contact Joe or myself. I'm available 24 hours a day. So is Joe. We'll get those questions answered.
The police have since clarified that they're not saying the parents aren't cooperating. They're saying the parents haven't sat down separated to talk with them. Has that happened?
Absolutely happened. Happened the very first day. 8 hours, Jeremy separate.
Since October 8th?
No, not since October 8th, but I'm explaining to you when it happened. 8 hours the very first day by Jeremy. 11 hours the very first day by Debbie. And then it happened again on October 8th. So the other, I alluded to five different contacts. There was 9 hours on October 6th, and then the October 8th thing was 3 hours, and then there was a couple of follow-up interviews that were short, but a total of in excess of 30 hours.
You said October 6th. Did you mean the 4th, the day that she
The 4th was the one that was 19 total hours, 8 for Jeremy and 9,
and there was another one on
11
the
for Debbie. There was another one on the 6th.
And then
another one on the 8th.
So there were three interviews where they were separated?
And the first two were without attorneys.
Okay. But in total, three?
Yes, sir.
Where they were interviewed separately?
Yes, sir.
Okay. So you're saying you're open and they can come and call you anytime and say, we need to ask Debbie more questions?
They can fax me, email Joe or myself, any question they may have, and we'll answer it. But what we're not going to do is let our clients be subjected to interrogation techniques. And it got nasty. You guys know Sean O'Brien. He was involved in the third deal. He's been a hero of mine. I think he's a fantastic lawyer and a great person. And he told me about what went on in that third interview. He ended the third interview. He'd had enough, and that's enough for us.
Are you alleging that police are lying?
Am I alleging that police are lying? It happens. You know, I've been doing this 20 years. It's constitutionally permissible for them to lie. I wasn't in the interview room, interrogation room. I know what they told Debbie and Jeremy, as it's been relayed to me. But as you know, you've been doing this a long time. What your clients tell you happened in the interrogation room and what really happened in the interrogation room are often two different things. We're not entitled, unfortunately, to get the videotape of that back unless and until a case is filed. And based on my experience and my training and what I've heard from my clients and what I've heard from Sean, I have no doubt that vigorous police interrogation tactics were used.
Do you think police are focusing too much on the parents?
Absolutely.
Do you think police consider them suspects?
Oh, they've told them as much, sure.
What have they told them?
Just what you just said, and Debbie in particular.
Can you explain?
I'm not at liberty to get into that, but you know that's the tenor of what's going on here.
What do you think happened to Lisa?
I don't know. I wasn't there. I know I'm not going to speculate about what did happen and what didn't happen. As lawyers, we deal with evidence and with the facts that we know. We have certain facts that we know that everyone can agree on, the FBI, KCPD, us. We have other facts that are sort of in dispute. At the end of the day, everybody has to make a judgment for themselves.
Isn't it important that you continue and that they continue to work with them as long as Lisa is still missing?
Absolutely. And, you know, that's another thing that has come up here. That's a dicey situation because law enforcement doesn't want us involved. They don't want our investigators going out and talking to these witnesses. The exact words from the FBI agent to me was, when I got involved, we don't want them, quote, poisoning the well, unquote. Okay? This is a sort of a different situation for a criminal defense lawyer to be in, because I know you guys probably saw my quote in the paper when I was asked. Typically, I don't like my clients to speak at all with law enforcement, and I won't allow it. But this is a different situation because our clients now want to help in finding their child. So we're kind of in a crosshairs. We want to make sure we protect them, but we want to make sure that we help them. That's where we are as far as that goes, and we've got to try to fulfill both roles.
But you understand, I'm sure, that in other cases, high-profile kidnapping cases, parents have pretty much done anything that they could, stand on mountaintops to get attention.
Exactly.
And these folks have made themselves unavailable. Well, so
that's not true.
Well, wait a minute. It's true as far as local media is concerned.
No, it is true.
Well, okay. I don't know that there's any duty on their part to talk to local media.
No,
I don't see that as them being...
All I'm saying is, do you understand that that does put them in the eye of the public, a little bit of an unusual situation?
No, I don't agree with that. I think it makes you guys mad at them. It doesn't put them in the eye of the public. I don't go along with that.
But
as far, hang on. As far as the... look at the JonBenet Ramsey case. I mean, what did that do? Look at the cooperation they provided. Look how those people's lives ended. We're not here to make you guys happy. We're here to help them find Lisa, if we can help them find Lisa. And we started off talking about their cooperation with the search. I want to go into that. They were not allowed back in their home. They were not allowed to go back in the woods. The police and law enforcement had that stuff on lockdown. They didn't want them down by the river. They didn't want them over there where that Section 8 housing is. So you tell me, if someone takes your child and you can't go in any of the places you would normally go to look at, is she now supposed to drive around? And by the way, that's been done, but shouting from the mountaintops for her child to satisfy the public? No, I mean, that's not the way to behave. We're letting the experienced, trained law enforcement people do their job. We've got our own investigators. They're doing their job. And that's the way it works.
Have they organized any searches of their own that we don't know about in other places that police aren't looking?
We've done our own investigation.
Have the parents done that? Mm-hmm. Have they been out
looking? We are working on behalf of the parents. We have investigators, and we are pursuing leads.
Earlier in the show, I mentioned that Deborah had been told that she failed the polygraph test. It has since been revealed that police told her that as a tactic to get her to crack.
We all know there are things in life that you have to compromise on, but when it comes to your health, there's no compromise. So don't settle for that one doctor that isn't really addressing your needs. Instead, check out ZocDoc, the place where you can find and book doctors who will make you feel comfortable, and you can even search by location, availability, and insurance. ZocDoc is a free app and website where you can search and compare highly rated in-network doctors near you and instantly book appointments with them online. Once you find the doc you want, you can book them immediately. You can filter specifically for ones who take your insurance, are located near you, and treat basically any condition you're searching for. The typical wait time to see a doctor booked on ZocDoc is between just 24 and 72 hours. That's it. I use this, and you should too. Go to ZocDoc.com/vanished and download the ZocDoc app for free. Then find and book a top-rated doctor today. That's zocdoc.com/vanished. Zocdoc.com/vanished. This message is sponsored by Greenlight. When you're a parent, you'll have your fair share of big talks with your kids. One of those big talks should involve money, and Greenlight can help with that. Greenlight is a debit card and money app for families. You can send your kids instant money transfers, get real-time notifications of spending, manage chores, and automate allowance. I've been using Greenlight with my older two kids for years. One thing that I love about it is that I can set up recurring or one-time chores, customized to my family's needs, and then my kids earn an allowance to reward them for a job well done. Not only does it motivate them to actually get the chores done, but it also teaches them a bit about financial literacy and independence. They're learning to earn, save, and spend wisely. So stop putting off the money talk and start putting your kids on the right path. Sign up for Greenlight today and get your first month free at greenlight.com/vanished. That's greenlight.com/vanished to try Greenlight for free. One more time, that's greenlight.com/vanished.
There are basically two major theories about what happened to Lisa. Either Deborah is responsible, or an intruder did in fact come into the home and take Lisa. There are several theories circulating about Deborah. One is that she possibly brought Lisa to bed with her sometime in the night and accidentally smothered her due to her drunken state and felt the need to cover it up. There also could have been some other kind of accident that caused her death and she felt like she had to cover it up. Another theory is that she did something to her in a drunken rage. If you look at the timeline in this case, it's pretty tight. I found myself wondering how she could have accomplished killing Lisa and disposing of her body without her son seeing or hearing a thing and no neighbors seeing her. We know she was drunk. Could she have been able to cover up a crime in that state? I've seen a lot of people point at the fact that she did not mention that she was drunk right away as some kind of indicator of guilt. Part of me can understand why someone would not want to admit that they were drunk when their child went missing. It does make her look like a bad mother, and the media totally jumped all over that. The fact that she said that she checked on her before she went to bed at 10:30, but then changed the story after she admitted to being drunk is another source of suspicion. The cadaver dog hit in her bedroom also points in that direction, but we have to remember that cadaver dogs are not 100% accurate. There's a gentleman who works with search dogs in the Facebook group for the show, and I reached out to him to ask a couple quick questions about this hit. First, I wanted to know how long someone would have to be deceased before a dog would be able to pick up on the odor of decomposition. And he said that there is a debate over that, and it could be anywhere from 45 minutes to a couple of hours. I also wanted to know what other things could possibly have caused this one hit. I asked about a bloody nose, and he said that dogs could pick up on a small amount of blood, and that it doesn't even take that much. He said you could cut yourself cleaning up a broken light bulb, and a couple drops of blood would be enough. One interesting fact is that investigators never took the carpet out of the house. The last question I asked was, with this one hit, should we assume case closed? He said no, but if they had had that one hit and then found blood that matched Lisa's DNA, that would be a different story. I would like to thank Michael for helping me out when these questions come up. The intruder theory does have some evidence to support it as well. The sightings of a man carrying a baby are very important. How often do you see a man out carrying a baby in the middle of the night? The phone call to someone that neither of the parents knew is very suspicious. The fact that the person who was called was a short walk away makes it even more suspicious. Add on top of that the guy staying down the street was the ex-boyfriend of the person called. If she was taken by an intruder, where is she now? Was she taken by someone who wanted a baby? Could it have been someone who wanted to sell a baby? Was it someone who wanted to harm Lisa? I struggle to wrap my brain around this case. Every time I would start to lean in one direction, something just didn't quite add up. So I decided to give Justin from Generation Y a call. He is from the area, so I thought his insight would be especially interesting. First, I asked him what it was like when Lisa vanished.
At the time, I was much younger, but I had friends that actually lived in the neighborhood where this went down. Also, it was on every local news station right after the event. And, you know, people are much more sensitive and passionate when it comes to a child or an infant for that matter. as opposed to an adult or somebody else being abducted or kidnapped. So this was big, big news. And for anyone that doesn't know, Kansas City, like the city itself, is about 500,000 people. But if you take in Kansas City, Missouri, Kansas City, Kansas, and all the burbs surrounding, it's over 2 million people. So it is a big city, but after this event, people in grocery stores and Walmart or whatever were talking about this in the lines. Everyone knew about this. It was like a small town mentality again, where everyone, in a sense, came together to discuss this. Some good, some bad, you know. That was the biggest thing that I remember from this was anywhere I went, it was on the TVs, and the waitress at the restaurant or the person ringing me out at the grocery store would be talking about it. You couldn't go anywhere. So it was big news. And for the most part, everyone felt the mother had something to do with it.
I remember it from years ago. And I remember thinking, oh, well, she totally did it. Like, what's the point of covering that, right?
Yeah.
But when I was looking into some stuff now, fast forward a few years, there were certain things that made me question that, or my initial thinking, to the point where now I'm kind of like 50-50 with whether she did or she didn't.
And that's where you should be, because it's a weird circumstance. I mean, she says she goes to bed. Her husband is out working that night. And the last time baby Lisa has been seen is around, what, 5 or 6 o'clock?
Yeah, it was like 6:40 was what she says. Some places say 6:30, as late as 7. So, I mean, it's not that much of a difference, but.
And then by morning, they know the baby's gone. And a screen window or a screen, you know, cover to a window has been pushed in. So do we have to assume that somebody with inside knowledge that knew when they were going to go to sleep and knew where the baby was going to be came in and took the baby? Or do we think that this was somebody that was going to, you know, just randomly came to the house to burglarize it and then decided just to kidnap the baby?
Yeah, and also the cell phones being taken or supposedly taken, I think is interesting. I see people commenting like, well, why would they just take the cell phones? But if you're carrying a baby out, you know, whether they went out the door or they went out the window, how are you going to carry the TV too? But cell phones you could put in your pocket.
Yeah, cell phones, wallets, small items, definitely. And also if they thought, well, they're using cell phones, I'm going to take their mode of communication so they can't call the police as quickly, so I have a longer getaway time. If they're actually being logical about it in any way.
Yeah, I thought the same exact thing. And I'm sure you saw this. The guy who was house-sitting and taking care of on one of the neighbor's yards.
Like kind of a homeless weird guy, something.
Yeah, homeless, would flop around at different places, would do handyman work in the neighborhood. Mm-hmm. He was seen in the area, and he was known to burglarize homes, and I believe he's currently in prison for doing just that. Mm-hmm. Somebody saw him take a neighbor's dog earlier in the day and just walk off with it. And then that dog showed up a few days later, several miles away, which is just odd. It's odd behavior. It'd be one thing for a child to go in and let somebody's dog loose, but a man, that's very odd.
Yeah, and with him, he's a suspicious character in the area. And I think you absolutely need to vet him, but they really didn't have anything on him.
Yeah, the phone call from the phone was to his ex-girlfriend who he broke up with 10 days earlier. That's one like sticking point for me, that phone call. It just makes no sense, because why would Deborah call this guy's ex-girlfriend?
They have no connection.
No, and they looked back in all their phone records for a year. So that's one thing that makes you go, okay, well, that's, you know, one thing that points in the direction of somebody else.
Yeah.
And also, it doesn't even have to be him, because she lived a block away. I mean, it could have been somebody else who close by who knew her. I saw people said that they frequently walk through there and cut through the one neighbor's yard to get to that apartment complex. So,
but there were dogs back there, and
yes,
they should have been alerting. But at the same time, if the dogs are always barking, does anyone pay attention?
Yeah, and that's true. What did you think of Deborah's changing stories?
Yeah, and she kind of changes her story up as it goes. And I can't tell if she's changing it because she has something to do with this, or if she's changing it because she doesn't want herself to look bad. But she starts admitting and conceding to more and more. So in the beginning, the early police reports were she was on sleeping pills. But then after a few more interviews, you hear she was drinking and she was drunk, and this is a daily occurrence for her.
Yeah, and I was wondering about that as well. Part of me goes, okay, well, if that were me and I was in that situation and my kid really was abducted, I would probably not want to make myself look bad. But at the same time, if that happened, I probably wouldn't care about making myself look bad and would just say everything and not. I was trying to put myself in her shoes. Okay, she probably didn't say she was drinking because she didn't want to look bad. But what if you were in that situation? Would you lie about something? It's not like drinking is a crime. No. I could see somebody just saying, I was drinking with the neighbor out on the porch, but not saying I got completely plastered with the neighbor on the porch. But she looks very bad because she changes that story. She looks very bad because she initially said she checked on her at 10:30 and then later says she doesn't know if she did because she was so drunk.
It starts to come out like the Madeline McCann kind of deal, where was she checking on him? Were they not checking on him? It comes into, is she coherent enough to know what time she went to bed?
If she was blacked out drunk like that, I could see the baby getting up in the night, her going and getting the baby and just bringing her back to bed with her instead of trying to get her to go back to bed in her crib. And then she could have rolled over on her. I mean, that's what they say, never to co-sleep with children when you are on any kind of sedative, whether it be alcohol or medication, because you're more likely to roll on them and suffocate them. So I could see something like that happening and then her covering it up. But the time frame is so small between when she goes to bed and people saw her, you know, beforehand, so we kind of have a good idea that that was around 10:30. If you're like blacked out drunk at 10:30, how do you successfully get rid of her when you are so intoxicated and get rid of any evidence? I mean, the only evidence they have is the cadaver dogs hitting on the carpet in her bedroom.
Typically, when a cadaver dog hits on that, the body has to be deceased for some period of time. But yeah, and I hadn't really heard a lot of theories on what she did or why she did it. So I kind of accept if she had done this, it might have been an accidental death. She might have rolled over and crushed the child. The child might have fallen out of the crib or the bed or did something, and she wasn't coherent or able to tend to this. So, but as far as the suggestions of she sold the baby to the black market or something like that, I didn't buy those kind of explanations.
No, I don't buy that either. That just seems pretty silly. I mean, when you look at pictures and videos of, you know, their home videos, she does seem to really care for the child, and the children seem to be well taken care of. Whether you want to judge her or not for drinking on the porch, there's probably a lot of people that do that, but I don't buy the selling the baby thing. I mean, I've seen people say that as far as an intruder goes, that an intruder came in to take the baby to sell her. But at the same time, I always question, okay, say you have the idea to steal a baby and sell it. Who are you going to sell it to? Right? I mean, how do you find, maybe I just don't have that criminal mindset, but how do you find someone to sell a baby to?
I guess if you were in a third world country, if you were in some sort of scenario where you had ties to mafia or underground, you know, things. But again, this is Kansas City, Missouri, not exactly a high crime, you know, anything. It's just, it doesn't make sense here in the Midwest. But again, maybe we're just naive to some of the workings and things going on, but it just wouldn't make sense to me.
I know, it doesn't make much sense to me either. I mean, it would make more sense to me if it were somebody who really wanted a baby, but usually that's women. And if you want to go off of the theory about the guy walking around the neighborhood with a baby, that doesn't necessarily fit that. Unless there's some woman out there who really wanted a baby and got somebody to go in and steal her. I mean, it seems far-fetched, but crazier things have happened.
Well, now we're back to the Jersey theory, where what if his ex wanted a baby or somebody he knew wanted one and they knew he was the man to do it?
Yeah. If that were the case, that somebody wanted a baby, I do think it would be possible if you had the means to get out of the area and not like this guy on foot who doesn't have a car and rides his bicycle around. I do think if you had the means to go somewhere and stay under the radar for a period of time for that child to change, grow hair and everything, I think you could definitely get away with something like that if you planned it out.
And plus, if you're selling this child, all the parties have to keep their mouth shut.
Yeah.
And when you involve more than one person, chances of that are pretty slim when it comes to this being national news and such a hot topic. I would be surprised that if that baby was sold to another family, that whole family's on board, or all of a sudden this baby just shows up and no one thinks, well, where did this baby come from? And what's this big thing in the news today? I would just assume that would work itself out.
Yeah, I think that's like, that is a very, very small chance of that happening. Unless you had somebody who came in and got that baby and then went to live, you know, out in the middle of nowhere with, you know, some sort of off the grid type scenario. I don't think that that's very possible. I doubt that, you know, she's still alive, to be honest. Somebody like this Jersey guy could have taken her with an intention like that and then realized, oh, shoot, this isn't going to be working out, and then had to get rid of her. I mean, something like that could have happened. And I'm on the fence because two things that keep me from definitely saying the mother did something are the phone call to that woman's cell phone and the sightings of the man with the baby.
The phone call itself, we've accused and charged and got prosecutions against people for murder with that same evidence.
The police recently said that those cell phones never left a third of a mile radius from that house that night.
So if the perpetrator had taken the cell phones, they were close by?
Yes, that's what they're saying. Now, I don't know the science behind that, and I don't know if that can be debunked in within itself, but that's what they're saying.
Cell phone tower data is a big mess. I mean, between Adnan and Stephen Avery, you could go down that rabbit hole for weeks. So, yeah.
Yeah, and so I was thinking, okay, well, there's several people within that radius, though. There's the Jersey guy who is staying at the house down the street, and then there's the people at the apartment complex. That's all within that radius. So, I mean, that doesn't really
point to the mom or to an outside force.
Yeah, so it just is like, well, that's interesting, but it doesn't solve it at all.
And you hit upon something earlier when you were talking about the mother being accused, and you know, when it comes to a child, expect the witch hunt. You know, everyone's going to want to place blame somewhere, and even if the mother is totally innocent and her child was taken, they're still going to blame her for being drunk. They're still going to blame her for not waking up. There's just no way that she comes out of this clean, because she is going to be held responsible for her baby being taken.
You could say, and whether this is true or not, if she was taken and the mother, had she not been drinking, maybe she would have woken up. But we just don't know that. Could have been on the other side of the house. You don't know. And I feel like if the mother's innocent, I feel really bad because she's been really put through the ringer.
Found guilty in the court of public opinion.
And I do feel bad if she is in fact innocent, because not only did she lose her child, but then she has all this blame put on her. They got attorneys, which I understand, because the police told her she failed a polygraph. They confirmed that that was in fact a lie and that she didn't fail it. So that was all over the news saying that she failed it. I understand why they use those tactics. Well, you know, they're kind of controversial. They can lie to you, but for her to believe that she failed a polygraph for several years and them not say, oh, you know, oops, we were just messing with you, is kind of unfortunate, I think.
And plus, if you tell the truth, if you say what your recollection of events is, and then someone tells you this absolutely is false, this evidence proves you wrong, or you failed a polygraph, you, 9 times out of 10, you're probably going to change your story a little bit to adapt to that, or give explanation of why possibly your story didn't match up.
Yeah.
Even if you told the right one the first time, you're going to change it just out of instinct to try to overcome the naysayers. So it's one of those things where you can nitpick it apart, but is it suspicious that she changed her story, or is it natural that she changed her story because of the police tactics?
I don't know if she had anything to do with it or not, but if she didn't, that would be really frustrating as a parent when you know that the police are focusing only on you. And if you know in your heart you had nothing to do with it, that would be incredibly frustrating.
It's sad, because she is absolutely guilty in most people's eyes. And I'm like you, I'm kind of 50-50, and with the one phone call to the ex-girlfriend, along with those phones they weren't activated, they couldn't make outgoing calls, but they could track if a call was made. It seems kind of weird that they would be used at all, especially in that fashion. So
I see people saying about the phones that why would somebody steal the phones and then check the voicemail? And I was thinking, okay, what if somebody was checking to see if there was any kind of activity regarding this child? I don't think that necessarily points to it being her. who attempted to check the voicemail.
Yeah, I mean, if anyone steals a phone, regardless of whether they stole a baby or other things, but if anyone has taken a phone, have they never checked the voicemails? They might.
I don't think that that points to her necessarily. I mean, we know this guy is kind of like a weirdo, so I don't think that it would be out of character for him to do something odd. He took somebody's dog earlier in the day. I mean, he's known to steal things. Also, that ex-girlfriend of his, and this is the other thing, we didn't even touch upon this, that dumpster fire, which was in the ex-girlfriend's apartment complex. Now, this guy was known to like to set things on fire. Could somebody who wanted to get the attention elsewhere set a dumpster on fire to get all the authorities to the dumpster while you're going in the opposite direction?
Yeah, or is he disposing of evidence?
Exactly. But I don't think she was in the dumpster, because I think that they would have found her. Some people said that, but it takes a lot to completely destroy a body with fire.
Yeah, you know, the bones would have still been there. But if there was other things stolen, like clothing or, I don't know, just kind of going down that rabbit hole.
But I think that the dumpster fire is interesting within itself, because it could be completely unrelated and just some kids messing around. But, I mean, what are the chances that that happens around 2:30 in the morning on the day that this little girl goes missing and there's somebody walking around the neighborhood with a baby? When I start going down that rabbit hole, I go, oh, it was totally that guy, that Jersey guy. But then I think, well, what happened to her then? Why haven't they found her? And so then I go, okay, let's look back at her. And then I've been wrestling with this one, because usually there's no good resolution, but this one has two that have really good evidence pointing in that direction. So it's making me insane.
Yeah, either one is a good resolution.
And the police seem to be not that interested in looking at that Jersey guy. They've said that they've spoken to him, he has cooperated, and they've moved on. So, it seems like they're putting all of their effort into Deborah, and I don't think they're really looking elsewhere, but who knows? There may be stuff that they know that we don't, that they haven't released.
Yeah, and at the same time, cops and investigations usually find their target and then focus in on that. And it's almost as if they have blinders up to anything else.
Yeah, and I think that they initially went after her and spent so much energy. Like, if in fact it wasn't her, they don't want to pursue other avenues because they've focused so much on her. You know, it almost makes them look bad that they wasted all this time on her.
It's either a question of pride that they can't admit they're wrong, or a question of just due diligence that they won't accept that there's any other alternative.
I would like to thank Justin for taking the time to speak with me for this episode. After talking with him and thinking this over for days, I'm really leaning away from the family being involved at all. If you have any information about the disappearance of Lisa Irwin, please call the Kansas City Police Department at 816-474-8477. That brings us to the end of episode 32. I would like to thank everyone for listening. If you do not follow this show on social media, I have a very exciting announcement about the show. The Vanished is now part of the Wondery Network. You can now listen to the show on Wondery.com along with all the other places you have been listening. I am sure that almost everyone listening has also listened to Justin's show, Generation Y, but for the one person listening who is not, go check it out. It is one of my personal favorites. If you would like to connect with me, you can find me on Twitter at TheVanishedPod. There is a Facebook page and a discussion group.
The group is private, so just ask to join and someone will approve you quickly. You can listen and submit topic suggestions at thevanishedpodcast.com. If you have a missing loved one and would like to have them featured on the show, please send an email to thevanishedpodcast@gmail.com. I also have a call-in line for the show, and that is 814-VANISH-9. Thanks everyone for listening. I hope everyone is having a great holiday weekend, and I will catch up with you all next week.
I love her too much to give up, and I love her too much to not believe that she's coming home. And we are very determined, stubborn people, and we're not going to give up until that day comes. It gets harder each year. And tonight was about getting her picture back out there, making sure that everybody knows that she is still missing, that someone knows where she's at, that there's a $100,000 reward, and for whoever has the information that will lead to bringing Lisa home, to please, please have a conscience and do the right thing. It's been 4 years. We've missed every milestone so far in her life. And she deserves to be home where she belongs. When we get her home and she's safe, that's when we stop. And then after that, I plan on trying to help other families and other children. So this is going to be a never-ending thing.
Whether you're working out, walking, or running errands, Audible can help you keep your heart rate up month after month with their pulse-pounding collection of thrilling audiobooks that you can't hear anywhere else. As an Audible member, you can choose one title a month to keep from their entire catalog, which includes thousands of titles. This month, check out the Audible original, The Space Within. It's a chilling 8-part story about a psychiatrist, Dr. Maddie Weil, voiced by Academy Award winner Jessica Chastain, who is tasked with unlocking the memories of a child who went missing for 7 hours. Maddie soon discovers that there are more who have faced similar experiences, and the truth of what is happening to them may impact the fate of humankind. New members can try Audible free for 30 days. Visit audible.com/thrill or text thrill to 500-500. That's audible.com/thrill or text thrill to 500-500.
1, 2, 3, 4. Those are numbers, but you already knew that. If you want to know what number you're going to pay each month for your car, use Kelley Blue Book My Wallet on AutoTrader. They're really good at numbers. AutoTrader.